The address is parstoday.ir/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Butt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Only weeks after he said the UK economy might have turned a corner, this announcement by the Bank of England's governor.
But let me be clear, inflation remains too high, and it's our job to get it all the way down to the 2% target and have it stay there. And this is why today we've increased bank rate by 0.25 percentage points to 4.5%.
Since it took measures to tackle the pace of price rises in the UK, the bank has now raised interest rates multiple times, raising questions among economists such as Professor Keith Pilbeam about the efficacy of the move.
Well, today's interest rate rise is just another indication of the failure of the Bank of England to do its job earlier. And had it raised interest rates well before it started raising them and raised them more substantially, we probably wouldn't be headed for even higher rates down the road, and certainly inflation would have been brought back under control.
The rate rise will have consequences, economists say, for other sectors of the economy, such as the housing market, where 2.5 million Britons will soon have to renew their home loans at higher interest rates. For months, increases in wholesale energy prices caused by self-imposed sanctions over the war in Ukraine were blamed for the unbridled inflation here. Energy prices have since eased, but inflation hasn't.
Well, what did Rishi Sunak do when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer? He borrowed well over £300 billion, increasing the fiscal deficit to 15% of GDP. How was that financed? It wasn't financed through tax rises. It wasn't financed through some sort of government cuts or anything like that. It was financed purely by printing of money by the Bank of England. £300 billion in one go, raising the UK money supply from £600 billion to £900 billion in the space of 1 year.
Rampant inflation has seen grocery prices shoot up by up to 20%. The demand for food banks doubled compared to 5 years ago, and months of public sector strikes for pay rises.
This is the 12th consecutive interest rate rise in less than 2 years, with the Bank of England leaving the door open for more hikes in the coming months. The question now is, when will the bank hit the pause button? Saeed Pourreza, London.
Hundreds of people attended a memorial service for slain Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. Abu Akleh held an American passport and worked for the Al Jazeera TV network. She was killed by an Israeli sniper on May 11, 2022, while she was covering an Israeli raid in the West Bank city of Jenin. Footage captured moments after she was shot shows her motionless body with another Palestinian reporter being seen next to her. Both are wearing easily recognizable press vests and blue helmets. Since her killing, Abu Akleh has been hugely remembered by Palestinians for her dynamism and courage to cover Israeli crimes. The road where her office was located is now named Shireen Abu Akleh Street.
Every morning we pass by her office to say good morning, Shireen. All our colleagues, including myself, who accompanied her when she was martyred, still think that she is on vacation and will be back to the office.
Shortly after her death, the U.S. government said evidence showed Abu Akleh was killed by an Israeli bullet. But ironically, Washington claimed that it had seen no evidence pointing to her killing being intentional, a line that has also been used by the Israeli regime. Washington also promised an investigation to find out the truth, but a year of U.S. inaction has prompted Palestinians to take the matter into their own hands.
The case has been submitted to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. We're still working to pressure on the Attorney General and the court itself to act and to take a stand in this regard, either by announcing the creation of an official independent international investigation committee or by simply announcing his position.
Abu Akleh was not the first journalist to be killed by the Israeli regime. A report by the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate published in 2023 shows Israel has murdered more than 50 Palestinian journalists in the past 22 years, but the regime has never taken responsibility for any of those killings. Many fear that Israel's impunity only means more Palestinian journalists will be killed in the future.
Israel wants to silence the free speech and the voice of the press, as well as the truth which convey the atrociousness of the Israeli occupation and its crimes.
Even Western politicians who are staunch supporters of Israel are now calling for an independent and thorough probe into the Palestinian journalist's murder. But after so many calls and too many letdowns, many are now questioning whether the situation would have been different if Abu Akleh had not been Arab or Palestinian.
Pakistan's Supreme Court has ruled that the arrest of the former Prime Minister Imran Khan was illegal, ordering his immediate release and asking the government to ensure his security. The court also urged the ex-premier to condemn the violent protests and emphasized that court's primary responsibility is to protect the citizens of the country. The country's top judge in his short verdict said that Khan would be kept in the police headquarters till his next appearance before the High Court on Friday over safety concerns. Khan was arrested by Pakistan's security forces on Tuesday over corruption allegations. The ruling Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz has criticized the country's Supreme Court for setting Imran Khan free, calling him a criminal.
The Supreme Court has double standards toward the government and Imran Khan. It has ruled that Khan, who is accused of corruption, should be provided with all facilities and be able to meet people freely. It would send a message that the courts are willing to compromise on justice. My only question is why the court has double standard.
The angry supporters of Imran Khan welcomed the Supreme Court decision, saying the release of their leader actually upholds the rule of law in the country.
Supreme Court of Pakistan ka shukr ada.
We are thankful to the Supreme Court for releasing Imran Khan from illegal detention by the government. The recent verdict of the top court will be considered as the supremacy of the rule of law in the country, which was violated by the current regime.
After being released by the court, the former PM expressed his grievances about his arrest, stating that he was abducted illegally and tortured during custody. Khan urged followers of his party to end their protests and refrain from damaging public and private property. Pakistan remains in the grip of deadly violence and protests after the arrest of the ex-premier.
Although the former Pakistani premier can now breathe a sigh of relief following the top court's decision, experts believe that Imran Khan has to prepare himself for more political challenges in coming days. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The fourth Tehran International Book Fair has opened in the Iranian capital. Some 2,700 domestic publishers and 100 foreign publishers from over 40 countries have attended this fair this year. The motto of this year's book fair is "The Future is Worth Reading." The international section of the fair aims to introduce the capacities of the publishing industry of the Islamic Republic of Iran to expand cultural exchanges in the international scene to lay the groundwork for communication between Iranian and foreign publishers. For the first time, bookstore owners can participate in the exhibition, and 200 have registered to compete with publishers in the virtual exhibition.
As you know, that Tehran Book Fair, one of the most important book fairs, that's Oman, Sultanate of Oman, that's need, that should be that participate. You know, as you know, that's more that visit to the book fair. And as you know, that's one of the most important, that's to participate the relationship between Oman and Iran That's most important and large. So that's from many years, that's about the relations.
For the second time, a virtual exhibition has also been launched to make books available to book enthusiasts. As usual, the books are available to the public at a discount. The rate of discount is 10% for the virtual exhibition and can be as high as 20% if you visit the fair in person.
The Tehran Book Fair provides a good opportunity for international visitors, book lovers, publishers, distributors and retailers to meet and do business and at the same time exchange culture during the 10-day event. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Syria and Turkey agreed to prepare a roadmap for developing relations between Damascus and Ankara. Relations between Ankara and Damascus soured after the foreign-backed militancy broke out in Syria in 2011, when flows of Syrian refugees flooded Turkey. The safe and dignified return of Syrian refugees was one of the key principles for the Moscow talks.
It has been a key principle for all the countries present here to contribute to a safe and voluntary return of refugees and internally displaced persons to the places of their permanent residence in Syria, as well as to ensure their right to receive support. It appears important to start discussing the issue of restoring disrupted transport and logistics ties between neighboring countries and resuming trade and economic cooperation without any barriers.
The participants also discussed the U.S. measures in creating a so-called Free Syrian Army, which used ISIS militants and other terrorist organizations against Syria's legitimate authorities with the aim of destabilizing the situation in the country. Russian and Syrian militaries have recently discussed the issue, agreeing on a model of joint action in that regard. The sides also discussed illegitimate unilateral sanctions applied by the U.S. and its Western allies, which block the provision of international humanitarian assistance to Syria, including through the U.N. The head of the Russian Foreign Ministry drew attention to the fact that the U.N. humanitarian plan for the current year for Syria was funded by 8%, but the emergency appeal of the same U.N. to provide assistance in the territories not controlled by Damascus was immediately paid almost in full.
The talks in Moscow can be called historic. Iran and Russia paved the way for the negotiation process in Syria and made great efforts to ensure that this meeting took place. Moscow has demonstrated that its conditions are realistic. It was supported by Iran in this, which has done a lot to save the sovereignty of Syria. The meeting of the Syrian minister and his Turkish counterpart gives hope for the establishment of calm in the country. Turkey had to come to terms with the fact that Bashar al-Assad's power will remain. We have witnessed a reset in relations and what the collective West has been trying to prevent in every possible way.
The process of normalizing relations between Ankara and Damascus was launched on December 28, 2022 in Moscow, when first consultations were held between the heads of the defense ministries of Russia, Syria and Turkey. Earlier, President Erdogan invited President Putin to hold a trilateral meeting with the participation of the Syrian leader. This summit, according to him, should have been preceded by negotiations at the level of representatives of the special services, defense and foreign ministers.
The foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Turkey and Syria warned that their countries will not allow any external interference in regional affairs. They expressed readiness to boost their fight against terrorism, saying they will be in full swing to ensure security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
EU leaders are accused of failing the people of Sudan. The 27-nation bloc's weak foreign policy in Africa has allowed tensions to develop into chaos and carnage, according to some legislators in the European Parliament.
We must understand that hoping for the best is not sufficient. If we do not engage constructively and in a timely, effective manner, we will always need to run for cover when it is already too late.
It's the Rapid Support Forces versus the Sudanese Armed Forces. Rival generals, once allies, are battling it out.
The West were happy to legitimize the de facto military dictatorship,
because this is the arrangement that has served our financial interests and the interests of the IMF and the World Bank for many years.
In the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, hundreds of people have been killed and thousands injured. The situation in Darfur and other regions is also dire. When it comes to African nations, the West is accused by critics of only ever having been interested in pillaging natural resources, such as gold, diamonds and oil. At least 450,000 people have been forced to flee their homes in Sudan since war broke out on April 15th.
Let us not allow for a new tragedy, or at least do the utmost of our efforts. If the EU wants to live up to its values, this is the time to go for our limits.
Foreign powers are competing for influence in Sudan because of its position on the map. Apparently, the EU has taken its eye off the ball.
Don't make the mistake to only focus on the war in Ukraine. All kinds of leaders seize the opportunity because they see the European Union as a soft power entity.
The EU has opened its doors to millions of Ukrainian refugees. The bloc is being criticised for not providing safe routes for those escaping Sudan.
I hope that this will be a matter for the meeting of the Foreign Affairs Council, which takes place this weekend. It's currently not on the agenda, and I would urge the Commission to try to address this.
Some commentators claim Washington is pouncing on the crisis with an aim of implementing ideological changes by removing Islam from Sudan's constitution. Once again, the US is accused of interference to try and further its own agenda. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On May 9th, Russia commemorates the capitulation of Nazi Germany to the Soviet Union and the 27 million Soviet soldiers and civilians killed in the World War II, known in Russia as the Great Patriotic War. This year, the victory parade on Red Square in the heart of Russian capital Moscow was held without the usual aerial maneuvers and with a minimum of equipment. With the latest military developments in the Ukraine war, fighter jets, tanks and missile defense systems were partly showed, as they are needed today at the front line. In his Victory Day speech, President Vladimir Putin said that the real war is once again unleashed against Russia, but the country will ensure its security and protect the inhabitants of Donbas.
Boundless ambition, arrogance and impunity inevitably lead to tragedies. This is the reason for the catastrophe the Ukrainian people are going through. They have become hostage to the coup d'etat and the resulting criminal regime of its Western masters, collateral damage in the implementation of the cruel and self-serving plans.
Vladimir Putin also criticized the demolition of monuments to Soviet soldiers and said the West is creating a Nazi cult. The president pointed out that the desecration of a generation of victors is a crime.
It is a crime, an outright revanchism on the part of those who were cynically and blatantly preparing a new march on Russia and who brought together neo-Nazis scum from around the world for this. Their goal, and there is nothing new about it, is to break apart and destroy our country, to make null and void the outcomes of World War II, to completely break down the system of global security and international law, to choke off any sovereign centers of development.
At 14, I became a partisan, then an infantryman, machine gunner. This is our victory, and we have won this memory. We see the depressing example of Europe. I want to say that Russians will never forget this day and will always remember it. Here, it will always be honored.
I'm from Makeyevka, from Donbas. My entire mining family has perished since 2014. Only one son remained. And today, I've come here in Moscow to pay my debt to all the defenders, the soldiers of our past and present.
Unlike last year, the Russian president did not announce new measures to support the participants in the special military operation, but noted the leaders of the CIS countries who came to celebrate Victory Day in Moscow. Together with Putin, the leaders of Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan watched the parade on Red Square.
For millions of Russians, May the 9th is a lot more than a national celebration. Today, Russians celebrate their victory over the Nazis in 1945. The Russians are one of the last who celebrate this holiday officially, remember which side were the heroes and at what cost the Soviets got this victory. Марина Картунова, Moscow.
In the limelight.
A global coalition has been formed to remove the US dollar from international trade. Iran has joined this action, providing a unique opportunity for the country to break the enemy's monetary and financial magic. From China and Brazil to Russia and India, they all agree on the same decision. The US dollar cannot be trusted. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. CNN has covered this story and tells us more. The United States Treasury Secretary has warned that economic sanctions imposed on other countries like Russia and Iran threaten the dominance of the US dollar in the global economic market. Janet Yellen said on Sunday, 16th of April, "There is a risk when we use financial sanctions that are linked to the role of the US dollar that over time it could undermine the hegemony of the dollar," she told the networks. Fareed Zakaria in an interview, "Of course, it does create a desire on the part of China, Russia, Iran and others to find an alternative." She, however, claimed that the dollar is used as a global currency for reasons that are not easy for other countries to find an alternative with the same properties. Janet Yellen claimed that sanctions are an extremely important tool, all the more so when used by the United States and its allies as a coalition partners acting together to impose those sanctions. "The global trend of substituting the US dollar with local currencies in the trade of goods and transactions has been on the rise in recent years, with various countries hoping to reduce their dependence on Washington and preventing it from further weaponizing its global dollar dominance." Observers cite China, Iran, Russia, and Venezuela as cases in point when it comes to conducting one's economic affairs and trade and important transactions independent of the greenback. They say powerful countries such as China, Russia, and the European Union are major players in the de-dollarization process today. These countries not only can avoid being subject to US jurisdiction and sanctions in many cases, but also weaken Washington's ability to remain the most dominant global power. The Washington Post has also covered this story and tells us more. With the emergence of China as a global power, the role of the US dollar as a payment currency has been threatened. According to some analysts, China is developing a cross-border interbank payment system based on the yuan that will link up with the payment systems in other developing countries. With the passage of time, this will reduce the chokehold of the US dollar in the SWIFT messaging system. The most recent of the deals struck on the de-dollarization process took place recently between China and Brazil. The two countries agreed to conduct trade transactions in their national currencies, leaving out the US dollar as an intermediary. The deal came after China and France agreed to conduct their first energy trade in Chinese yuan. China has already reached similar currency deals with other countries, including Russia. It is worth mentioning that the Chinese yuan has surpassed the euro to become the second largest currency in the foreign reserves of Brazil, South America's biggest country. Not only did South American countries like Brazil ditch the US dollar in their transactions and move towards China's yuan, since the beginning of the Ukraine war and the vicious campaign against Moscow, including Western sanctions and excluding Moscow from much of the global financial system, Russians have also turned to the Chinese yuan as their currency of choice. Of course, Russia started prioritizing the de-dollarization process in 2014, following the annexation of Crimea and in response to Western sanctions. According to media reports, the yuan has replaced the US dollar as the most traded currency in Russia, with almost all the big banks offering services and deposits in the Chinese yuan. As Russian President Vladimir Putin described the outcome of his meetings with his Chinese counterpart, President Xi Jinping, in Moscow, he said, "We're in favor of using the Chinese yuan for settlements between Russia and the countries of Asia, Africa, and Latin America." The website of Press TV has also covered this story and tells us more. The European Union has also been circumventing US sanctions through the use of euros in its trade with the Islamic Republic of Iran. According to figures by the EU Statistical Office, the Eurostat, European Union's exports to Iran increased 7% year-on-year in January of 2023, while trade exchanges between the two sides exceeded 400 million euros over the same month. Several countries in West Asia and North Africa have also started to move away from the greenback in recent months. Countries like Iraq, United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. A report published by Elements newsletter said that Brazil and Argentina have been discussing the creation of a common currency since the beginning of 2023. At the time, the United Arab Emirates and India studied the option of using rupees to trade non-oil commodities. Moreover, Indian Commerce Secretary Sunil Bathwal said Indian rupees will be used in trade between countries that are facing a shortage of US dollars or currency failure. He said trade between India and Malaysia can now be settled in INR. The report also said that Saudi Arabia, for the first time in almost five decades, is open to trade in currencies besides the US dollar. Recently, Iran's top security official said the move to reduce the use of dollar in regional and international transactions, joined by several countries, would minimize the West's dominance over the global economy. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, cited the initiatives that have been finalized between Iran and Russia in the financial sector and banking exchanges to fund joint projects as an effective paradigm for neutralizing the West's unlawful sanctions against the two countries. The Sputnik News Agency has also covered this story and tells us more. Deputy Chairman of Russia's State Duma, Alexander Babakov, said on 30th of March that the BRICS bloc of emerging economies, that is Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa, was working on developing a new currency that will be presented at the organization's upcoming summit in Durban, South Africa. The bloc is working on finding ways to reduce dependence on Western currencies, especially the US dollar. The deputy chairman of Russia's State Duma, Alexander Babakov, said on the sidelines of the Russian-Indian Strategic Partnership for Development and Growth Business Forum, he said, "The transition to settlements in national currencies is a first step. The next step is to provide the circulation of digital or any other form of a fundamentally new currency in the nearest future. I think that at the BRICS Leaders Summit, the readiness to realize this project will be announced. Such works are underway." BRICS member states account for more than 40% of the global population and around a quarter of the global GDP. Recently, former US President Donald Trump said during remarks to the National Rifle Association, he said, The US dollar will soon no longer be the world standard currency. Donald Trump said, "Our currency is crashing and will soon no longer be the world standard, which will be our greatest defeat in the past 200 years. Even though many economists say no other currency can dominate over the US anytime soon, prominent economists, including American economist Nouriel Roubini, who predicted the financial crisis of 2008, do not rule out the eventual demise of the US dollar as a reserve currency within a decade.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavit Tafwai. Palestinian resistance groups and Israel have agreed on a ceasefire. Palestinian factions say the ceasefire has been brokered by Cairo. The agreement follows 5 days of the Israeli onslaught and bombing campaign on the besieged Gaza Strip and retaliatory rocket attacks from resistance fighters hitting Israeli settlements. Characteristic of Israeli bombing campaign, there is a disproportionate use of force that was reflected in the death toll. 33 Palestinians were killed, many of them women and children. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how Israel has failed when it comes to not achieving its desired outcomes. Joining us for this program is Mukhaibar Abu Sada. He's a professor of political science at Al-Azhar University. And we also have Zakir Ahmad Mayed, who's an attorney, activist, and political analyst, joining us from Johannesburg.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Mukhaibar Abu Sada, let's first start with you. There's a ceasefire that was agreed upon by both sides, it appears, where Egypt was the mediator. It actually is supposed to start right when our program started. We have to wait and see whether that's going to actually hold or not. But what's interesting about the ceasefire is that you had Israel saying that just hours before, maybe in the morning time, where you had Israel that said, we are not interested in a ceasefire. It even claimed that the Islamic Jihad had thousands of rockets and we need to continue with this operation. Why do you think then it would agree to a ceasefire if it knows that there's a finite number of rockets that the Islamic Jihad has, might as well have gone ahead and finished the job?
It's true, as you just indicated, a ceasefire will be in place in about half an hour from now, 10 p.m. Gaza time, Jerusalem time, which would mean the formula for this ceasefire agreement is that both sides, the Palestinian resistance groups and the Israeli occupation, will not target civilians and civilian infrastructure, including Palestinian civilian homes. That is the formula that has been accepted by both sides just about an hour ago. It's true, as you just indicated, up until this evening, Israel was not acceptable of the ceasefire formula that was presented by the Egyptian mediators yesterday, which asked Israel, upon the request of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, that Israel put an end to its assassination policy, which has in which Israel has used many times, and it has used 5 days ago when it assassinated three top members of the military wing of the Islamic Jihad. Therefore, we are witnessing a new formula that has been accepted by both sides. But let me also add one more point before I finish. Here, after 5 days of fighting between Palestinian resistance groups and the Israeli occupation, 33 Palestinians have been killed. More than of them are Palestinian civilians, including six children, four women, and other Palestinian civilians. In the meantime, the Palestinian resistance groups, mainly Palestinian Islamic Jihad, have fired more than 1,000 rockets against Israeli towns and villages, and most of these rockets were fell inside the territory of the Israeli occupation. It's been painful for Israel. Israel thought that it will be a very limited and very speedy operation. Israel did not think that this operation will last for 5 days, which has been criticized by the Israeli public, Israeli opposition, who thought that Israel has paid a very heavy price, especially financial price, over the past 5 days.
All right, Zakir Ahmed, over to you. Here you have a ceasefire that's been announced. And when you take a look at the operation I don't want to say who won and who lost, because it can't really be put in those plain terms. I mean, after all, there were 33 Palestinians that were killed. But when you take a look at the purpose that Israel was after, what did it really achieve? Yes, it did assassinate some of the Islamic Jihad leaders, but is that going to safeguard itself from...
Frenetic operation within Gaza, spurred on by the, and I would go with this word, assassination of Shahad Adnan, the key figure within Islamic Jihad. It definitely created the situation. They started striking Gaza as well, and naturally there's going to be a response by the resistance. Israel's approach, and there's an interesting article that just came out a few days ago with regards to the Israeli policy on this particular operation. Amir Rappaport was the author, and he has written for the Begin Sadat Center, and also was the editor of Israel Defense at one stage, and he said that this is a typical attempt by Israel to establish deterrence capacity, namely create a short kinetic operation, come to a ceasefire. And we've seen this repetitive pattern over the years. We saw it in 2012 with the assassination of one of the Hamas commanders, Ahmed Jabari. There was an Operation Pillar of Defense. We have ceasefires. We have the same thing in 2014, Operation Protective Edge, ceasefire. We see the same thing now. I think one key aspect that changed this, and there was a very key point that you raised with my other fellow panelists, is what changed between this morning and now on the Israeli side to spur on this particular ceasefire. And that is the entrance of Izzeddin al-Qassam, the Hamas movement, into the field with heavier weapons. There was a report of an 80GM anti-tank guided missile strike on a group of Israeli soldiers. Casualties were now being seen. And this changes the framework. Israel wanted to keep it a small operation so that they can make the public see it as a successful operation. However, when it goes into a larger regional conflict with the entrance of Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, and many of the other groupings of Al-Muqawwam al-Islamiyah, this becomes a clear defeat and loss for Israel. So therefore, we have to understand it within the context. It's not going to stop Israel, but I do believe Al-Muqawwam al-Islamiyah is looking at the flag march for a larger escalation. I believe that is the assessment of the situation on the ground right now.
Mukhabar Abu Sada, you talked about the rockets and how that was one of the achievements made by the Islamic Jihad and resistance groups as a whole. Basically, over 1,000 rockets, as you said, made it, 1,100 rockets have been fired from Gaza, 300 intercepted by the air defenses. So let's see, you got 800 that actually then made it. Now, in terms of the areas that it hit, it seemed like the number of areas in terms of towns, Israeli towns and cities, was increasing, and the targets were becoming more effective. But you have the success rate be a minimum 30% or higher, which even two rockets could achieve the goals. But what does that say about the way that Israel looks when you have that happening, and a so-called missile dome system or Iron Dome missile shield defense system that is unable to really intercept the rockets? And it is also said that if all the resistance groups from the Gaza Strip were to fire all the rockets all at once, that would inundate Israel and it would create huge damage.
That is definitely a very important issue here. As you just indicated at the end of your question, it was only the Palestinian Islamic Jihad who have been fighting Israel for the past 5 days. Yes, the fighting was under the name of the Joint Operations Room, which include other Palestinian groups, but mainly Israel has been targeted the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and the rockets that were fired from Gaza against Israel was very much done by PIJ, even though it came under the name of the Joint Operations Room. Now, even according to Israeli statistics, the shooting of more than 1,000 rockets, and some of these rockets reach Tel Aviv area, which is 80 kilometers from Gaza, and another rocket reached the surrounding of Jerusalem, which is almost 100 kilometers from Gaza. That has been a tipping point for the PIJ, that it has done so. And as you very much know, that one Israeli was killed in the missile that hit the Israeli city of Rehoboth 2 days ago, and the injury of 9 other Israelis. But the most important issue here is that the miscalculation of Israel. Israel felt that by killing and assassinating the 3 top members of the military wing of PIJ, it thought that that will paralyze PIJ and it will not be able to retaliate, but that was completely not true. PIJ was able to regroup itself, was able to retaliate, and was able to stay steadfastness in spite of Israeli retaliation and Israeli aggression over the past 5 days.
All right, let's do a history check over here. I think you kind of went into that, Zakir, in terms of what you mentioned. Let me just make sure I have my stats straight here. We're looking at 15 military operations that Israel has carried out in the Gaza Strip since the year 2005. And the basic question that comes out of these military operations is, what are these campaigns achieving? I mean, what are they doing? We know, of course, how many Palestinians have been killed. But, when you take a look at the goals and objectives, it seems like Israel has to exercise and execute these bombing campaigns or military escapades, if you want to call them, or incursions. But what are they really achieving if it has to get repeated?
Just before I answer your question, I just got a notification now that Tel Aviv is being targeted as we speak. Sirens are going off in Tel Aviv, so we can see that the resistance is as strong as it was when it began. As you go to the question that you've just raised now, what is the purpose and what is the policy objective behind this? The policy objective has always been to try and maintain Israel's deterrence capacity. In simple words, it's the fear of Israel that Israel will go completely insane if you engage in a military confrontation with it. It's exactly what they tried to do in 2006 with Lebanon, with the Tahiyya principle developed by Major General Giora Island and a few of the other military establishment officials. And this is the aim of this, to try and scare the population that surrounds them into fearing Israel's retaliation. And also, this is to create a perception that Israel is capable, it's a fighting force, and it can unite its people. Particularly now, this is important, when Israel is so fractured at a domestic level, they needed a rallying point. And war serves as a sure crowd pleaser for the Israeli society. Nothing unites the Israeli society more than the bloodletting of the Palestinians. So this was key for Israel to engage in it now, as it has always been. You've pointed out a very clear pattern, and it's correctly placed that this is a policy decision of Israel. However, what has changed in the last few years is that Israel's space of maneuvering has surely narrowed. What you have now is a new equation that has developed due to the unification of the fronts, that any transgressions will be answered not in one arena. When you listen to Israeli military assessments, it always separates Gaza from the West Bank. It always separates Gaza, West Bank from East Jerusalem, and Al-Quds. It separates it from the arena of Lebanon. And these are the frameworks in which Israel operates. However, now it's very different. Transgression in one arena equals a transgression in all, and what you have is now grades of escalation that are taking place. You'll have an engagement in Gaza, it will deplete Israel's capabilities, and then move on. Just a point on the missile interceptors that you had raised with my fellow panelists, the Iron Dome has been hacked multiple times during this operation. In fact, just before we came on air, the Iron Dome had been hacked in Sidroten around Ashkelon, and they had no capability to intercept. That is why you're having such a poor interception rate, number one, and you've already spent $74 million USD just on Tamir interceptor missiles. It's an insane amount, and you have not much to produce for it. There's massive damage on the Israeli side. The society has been in bunkers, and as I've just mentioned already, Tel Aviv is being attacked as we speak.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting about this, I'm curious, Khabir Abbasada, as to why Israel continues with its bombing campaigns on the Gaza Strip every so often and in intervals. Perhaps I should quote the Hezbollah Secretary General, who has said, Netanyahu, and I'm quoting him, cannot lie to Israeli society by saying that he has restored deterrence as the resistance in Gaza stands strong, and it has thwarted the enemy's goal of restoring deterrence. I mean, that is definitely true, especially if we want to take a look at this truce, which is announced after 5 days. Do you see that as a withdrawal of Israel's military might to the point where it can't go on with a massive military and bombing campaign, given what we just have witnessed, if it holds again this truce that has been reached between Israel and the Islamic Jihad?
Well, let me answer the first part of your question. There is no dispute about the fact that Netanyahu decided to go on with this operation for his own internal and personal agenda. We all know that Netanyahu was viewed as a very weak leader in Israel, and Israel has been facing a very deep split between so-called liberals and right-wing and religious political parties for the past 5 months since the start of this government. Israeli leftists and center-leftists have been protesting almost every Saturday since the beginning of this year, protesting against Netanyahu and his coalition. And it was an excuse for Netanyahu to go with this operation to kill the top military commanders of the PIJ to try to show, to unite the Israeli public behind him. That's one thing. And second, Israeli so-called Israeli deterrence has been weakened lately by rockets being fired from Gaza, and also rockets were fired from South Lebanon about a month and a half ago. And the inability of Israel to fight back or to retaliate, that's one thing. And also the courage of the Palestinian resistance and Lebanese resistance to launch rockets against Israel led to the so-called of weakening of Israeli deterrence. And Netanyahu has been repeating and saying that the goal of this operation is to is to get Israeli deterrence or restructure Israeli deterrence in the face of Palestinian resistance and other groups. But look, I can tell you that this is just a big joke. There isn't anything called Israeli deterrence. The resilience of Palestinian resistance and its ability and capability to keep shooting rockets up until this moment, as we are speaking right now, that sirens went off in the surroundings of Tel Aviv area, Holon, Rishon LeZion, and other areas, and also in the enclave of Gaza, where Palestinian resistance groups are shooting rockets up until this moment. That means there is nothing called Israeli deterrence. If Israeli deterrence has succeeded, that could have deterred the Palestinians from shooting rockets anymore. But that is just to make Netanyahu look bad in the eyes of the Israelis, and that the goal of this operation was a failure from day one.
I'm sure you're going to have many analysts come out, and maybe they have already, and reached that conclusion. But Zahir, taking a look at what I think this is what maybe is the key here, the statement that the Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Yoav Gallant, said. He said that the likelihood of a major escalation in one arena would most likely quickly spread into multi-front war. Our guest there, Mukhabab Asada, talked about how you know, there's been rocket fire coming from the Gaza Strip, coming from southern Lebanon. You may see it come from Syria. You may see it come from different fronts. And maybe that is why Israel perhaps maybe agreed to a truce. Yoav Gallant also said this is the end of the era of limited conflicts. What do you think about the stance as revealed through this Israeli Minister for Military Affairs?
Sure, no. Allahu Akbar. May the resistance be successful. The way we look at it is this is a united battle. There's grades of escalation. This is a means of depleting Israel's capability to defend itself. The next phase of the battle will come. I believe one of the tipping points and flashpoints is going to be the march, the flag march that will take place on the 18th. The resistance is fully on board. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has mentioned it as well. And this is very clear. All the statements have indicated this. And the meeting in Damascus before this, with all the factions, including Iraqi factions, have indicated that we are united. I believe in the victory of Al-Muqawama.
Thank you so much. We're going